Imagine punching foreigners, you speak Italian. Imagine waking up, young got the bag in, but waking up broke, man, my can't imagine.
Random T's on that rope, can you imagine that? She random T's on that poke, can you imagine that? Wake up every day and go punch the clock. Dodging rays, we're trapping on the block. You lost it all on the site. Fuck up the work, you better get it right. Better watch that bitch, you trying to set the play.
Hey, imagine that, get in the jam, your man's fold on you. Imagine that, he took the stand like he done told on you. Drum on the cake, this is the size of Andre Drummond, but don't be a damn dummy. Bullets hot as crack spots, workers leaping like junkies. Peep that little bitch on the pole, going dumb in that one piece. I'm tapping like stay on point, you know we dodging the hook. Yeah, you right, we deep as fucking got the whole car rocking. Imagine that, fresh off the road with the low, headed straight to the strip. Just to bless somebody, to say a place to get tits. It's cool, but not on us, you would get left. Duct tape and hard drive, she thought she had her a plug.
Random T's on that road, can you imagine that? She random T's on that pole, can you imagine that? Wake up every day and go punch the...
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And Peter Robbins is an investigative writer specializing in the subject of UFOs. He has more than 35 years experience as a writer, researcher, investigator, lecturer, and author. A regular fixture on radio shows in the U.S. and in the U.K., he has appeared as a guest on and been consultant to numerous TV programs and documentaries. Robbins was spoken on UFOs, Dr. Wilhelm Reich, related subjects at local, regional, national, and international conferences, as well as for schools, universities, libraries, and organizations. He is a co-author, along with Larry Warren, of a British bestseller, Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. He was a founding member of Bud Hopkins Intruder Foundation and was Hopkins' assistant for many years. He was the event coordinator for Sci-Fi Channel's Alien Abduction Phenomenon, a symposium organized to promote the release of Steven Spielberg's miniseries Taken. And from 2007 until 2010, was a consultant to the City of Roswell, New Mexico, and coordinator of their annual UFO symposium. He has an upcoming presentation on the life and death of our first Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal. And Peter was a guest on this show back in 2012. And so we're honored to have him back with us. Welcome back, Peter.
Hi, it's so good to be back on the show again, Dave.
Certainly appreciate you coming back to be with us. Always have something interesting to say. And the last time you were on this show, we discussed your book, Halt in Woodbridge. And I suggested a conference call with the good Colonel and tried to contact him for that purpose, but he never replied to my request. Were you ever able to contact and speak with him?
Yes, and I do think probably it's best to deal with this right now at the beginning of the show, because you mentioned my co-authoring the book Left at East Gate, mm-hmm. about the well-known Rendlesham Forest UFO incident in England,
okay.
Which indeed is one of the most important UFO events that we've been able to document. However, that book, my request, our publisher did an investigation of now what are widely regarded as the completely false claims of my co-author.
Oh.
And made it clear to the publisher, who I have tremendous respect and admiration for, that we both felt that we were engaged in a nonfiction book, not a partially nonfiction book.
Mm.
But sadly, my co-author Larry Warren has emerged as a sociopath and a chronic liar who basically inserted himself in the story, took part of another man's story, and continues to tell his side, if you want to be generous. Halt in Woodbridge was one of two follow-up books that I wrote. That one that was available in regular book form, and about a year before that, a book called Deliberate Deception, addressing what I felt were inaccuracies in the book written about the Rendlesham incident by my colleague Nick Pope and two of the first night Rendlesham witnesses, John Burroughs and Jim Peniston.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that I included quite a number of inaccuracies in both Halt in Woodbridge and in Deliberate Deception.
Mm-hmm.
And although in Halt in Woodbridge, Mr. Halt, who I have been in fairly cordial contact with a number of times since all of this exploded, and certainly respect and wish well, he was wrong in a number of assertions about Larry. Not that I blame him, but ultimately between them and Larry's the parts of the book that supported him that were based on erroneous information resulted in my withdrawing both of those follow-up books from print. And a year ago this month, our publisher, Cosimo Press, in New York, with very mixed feelings on my part, because there are parts of Left at East Gate that I will always be proud of, and my contributions too, were compelled to agree with me, and so that book was removed from print as well.
Mm.
So you might say that I'm a best-selling published author with three books or two and a half books under my belt with absolutely no books in print. It has not been a great period of time for me in that sense, and I've spent a good deal of the past year and a half or two apologizing to quite a cross-section of people, from readers who I will never meet around the world to well-known people who bought Larry's account because I worked so hard with good intentions and a certain amount of naivete to sell it.
Yeah. Well, you can only report what the alleged witness has told you, you know?
Well, I did my background investigations in great part, but 30 years ago, I was not the investigator I am today. Mm-hmm. Plus, and I've reviewed this in my mind numerous times, nothing in my makeup or character prepared me or even allowed me to seriously consider that this person who approached me more than 30 years ago to co-write a book with him was already not telling the truth about aspects of it and looking for somebody, unfortunately, in a way, with my goodwill, positive outlook, temperament, to help him pull the wool over the eyes of numerous readers, and I guess was pretty lucky to find me in a sense. And it was a very rough process for me to realize that I had been so taken in, embarrassing as well as infuriating. And but you know what? Life goes on. I have redirected myself into other areas of work, gone back into important aspects of what I think was work being done during and before that time, including really going right back to my beginnings in this work seriously with Bud Hopkins, one of our favorite people in the field. And for any of your audience members who are not familiar with his name, the investigative writer and researcher who made the serious scientific investigation of the so-called UFO abduction phenomena, a field of research worthy of respect, although certainly there were people who were already doing it, but a handful. Mm. And I was fortunate enough to be his assistant for about half of our 35-year friendship, and a project that I'm developing right now goes right back into those days, as well as continuing, as you mentioned, research into a figure I find absolutely fascinating, seminally important, and all but forgotten by the great majority of Americans, even those with an interest in post-war history, that being James Forrestal, our first Secretary of Defense, okay, who I have been speaking about and writing about for many years, but continue to dig in and deepen my understanding of his life and, in a way more important, the circumstances surrounding his death, mm-hmm, and presenting it to a widening variety of people in a way that I hope reaches more and more of an audience. And what I mean by that last part is history, official history, tells us that on May 22nd, 1949, about 6 weeks after he stepped down from his post and our second Secretary of Defense took over, a man named Lewis Johnson, the nervous breakdown that apparently was building up within him manifested itself profoundly. He was institutionalized in the Bethesda Naval Hospital, certainly the right thing for a former Secretary of Navy that was in crisis. And early on that morning of May 22nd that he was supposed to be released from the hospital, we are told he had kind of a last-minute profound suicidal depression, surprisingly found his door unlocked, made his way across the hallway, where, what do you know, it was a window that was unsecured, and threw himself out. In fact, he was murdered, and I present that case in no uncertain terms.
Hmm. Well, I've heard this story about Forrestal before, and I do want to get into Forrestal, because I know you're going to be giving a lecture. But let me ask you this one question about Rendlesham, and then we'll drop the subject, okay?
That's okay. We can talk about it.
I just wanted to wrap up by saying, by asking you the question, the Rendlesham Forest case is a real UFO case. Am I correct in saying so?
Oh, yes. Yes. Despite the confusion and time wasting caused by my former co-author, it is one of the best documented, most fascinating, and well-researched UFO incidents on record. It is certainly far and away the best known UFO-related event in the history of Great Britain that we in the world UFO research community are aware of. And because it happened in a decidedly military context, there are military and civilian witnesses, credible ones, a very fascinating military paper trail, and a history ongoing of unusual events in the area. Long answer to your short question.
Okay. No, that's fine. That's fine. All right. So I'm going to take a break right now just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with author, researcher, lecturer, Mr. Peter Robbins. And so I wanted to do that now a little bit early so that I get that out of the way so I don't interrupt you again. You're going to be giving a lecture on James Forrestal in April. Okay, where will that be?
Right now, that has been changed to another subject. However, what I'd like people to know is I have taken kind of a turn in the road in terms of working with another idea for presentation. As you know, David, myself and my colleagues appear at conferences or libraries, whatever kind of venue we're invited to speak at, and do just that with the material that we're dealing with. I have a part of my background is in off-Broadway theater management. And I don't know, a year and a half ago, it began to occur to me that much as I hope I am able to educate folks as well as hold their attention in giving talks at large and small venues, that I just began to try to think of a different approach to the material that might reach an entirely different audience. I've never written a play. I have no training as a playwright, although I've worked in management for some very fine plays off Broadway. But I felt that this material had such a natural drama to it. There are aspects of it that you couldn't possibly make up if you tried. And it's like a Greek tragedy when one looks back on it in terms of the life of a very dedicated public servant who had a genuine hand in helping us win World War II, and in his time was in fact the second most powerful man in America, and one could argue the world for a number of a year and a half while he was Secretary of Defense. And what I came up with was taking the material that I had traditionally presented in the form of a conventional lecture and breaking it down into what I'll have to call a two-act dramatic reading, where rather than, you know, showing images as I go, images would be appearing behind myself or the person giving that presentation, more or less in the form of a one-person play with a break, but every single word of it, absolutely factual. And I've workshopped it several times in New York City with a terrific audience in Rochester, New York, where I speak several times a year to the UFO group there. And I'm at a point right now where, depending on whether or not I can find the right collaborator, actually turning it into a play. I don't feel comfortable, certainly not at this point, as an investigative writer, inventing dialogue, even if it's scrupulously based on what happened, and things that we know that Forrestal was involved in. And if so, giving it an opportunity to go into the hands of a professional actor, ideally a respected and well-known one, to take on as a serious, say, hour and a half with a proper break play in theaters. And this is still very much in the figuring it out stage, but it's actually quite exciting to me, and I will keep you posted on where we go with it.
Okay. So are you saying that this lecture that you planned on giving on Forrestal is no longer?
I have given dozens of lectures on Forrestal, and I'm sure we'll be doing others. It's just that I'm going to be doing another subject for the group, which is in Syracuse, and we're not sure on the exact date right now.
Okay.
But I have other talks coming up. The next major one is going to be in Laughlin, Nevada, the last week in March. And it's an event that a lot of us are looking forward to, and that those folks who are serious about the subject of UFOs in your audience should be aware of. Some of them will remember that before the terrific International UFO Congress was held regularly in Phoenix, it was held in a little border town in Nevada called Laughlin.
I was there.
Yeah, sure, exactly. we both were there, and the thing that I thought was amazing about it, and we're probably only joined by thousands of people over the years, is it ran for a week, 7 full days and 8 nights, and they'd bring in dozens of speakers, and the audiences could be 1,500, 2,000 people. The thing that so distinguished it, besides the obvious fact there, is that for speakers, you gave your talk. You might be on a panel discussion. If you had books or, you know, a DVD or what have you to sell, you'd be doing that part of the time. But the rest of the time, you basically just hung out with people. Were there to answer questions, discussions with them or with other speakers, all very informal. Those people that came, and they came from around the world. It meant that, you know, you weren't at a weekend conference where you might get to say, gee, I like your book, when, you know, somebody signs it at the table and you go away. It means that you had a chance to have a real conversation with an author or a researcher or an investigator or personality in the field or certainly a witness or an experiencer. That you would not normally have had more a chance to build a real acquaintanceship and sometimes a real friendship. And at a certain point, the organizers, the great Bob Brown and his dear late wife and his amazing daughter, decided to move on to other things, and that franchise changed hands. But as of March, it will be coming back under the name of UFO MegaCon, and it will have, I forget the number of speakers, but it is considerable, and you can Google it now under UFO MegaCon and see if it's something that would appeal to you. And once again, it will be a full 7 days, which I am really excited about. So
Where will this be? Will this be?
It's going to be back in Laughlin.
No, but I mean, what particular? Is it a casino hotel? Or?
Yes, exactly. It is a casino hotel. The name escapes me at the moment. But again,
Aquarius.
There you go.
Aquarius, yeah.
There you go.
That's where they had it, anyway.
Yes, and a great, you know, I mean, it's a wide-open old western town, old-fashioned gambling town. They certainly were able to secure a terrific deal for anybody. It's going to give you the most bang for your buck, no question about it. And one of the things I really admired about the new plan is that they decided, rather than inviting a whole slew of the best-known people, they decided instead to invite a whole slew of the ones who are not so well-known and give them a chance to basically get out there and do their thing and report their work to the audience. I was very flattered in that. I was the last person asked to speak there. I think I'll probably be among the handful of what we'll laughingly call well-known folks.
I was going to say, why are you? I should be in the little-known. You know, not you.
Maybe next year.
Maybe next. Keep me in mind.
They gave me a challenge, David, that I couldn't turn down. Normally, if I'm invited to speak, and they're not determining what they want me to speak about, I'm the kind of presenter that will say, here's a list of a dozen or 15 different topics. With short notice, I am ready to go on a full hour or an hour plus full PowerPoint lecture. You've only to choose it, tell me how long I have, and I'll tailor it and, you know, deliver the goods when I see you.
Mm-hmm.
What they asked was, we would like you to speak if you will speak on something you have never spoken about before, and taking it one step further, that to the best of your knowledge has not been presented at a conference, or so rarely that it would be, you know, new information for the folks hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I accepted the challenge, not knowing what it was going to be. And I thought about it, meditated on it, went over lots of notes from over the years. And what I put together was the following. Because of the privileged position I had working as Bud Hopkins' assistant for so many years, mm-hmm. and being part of, to be blunt, several hundred individual investigations, and I'm not exaggerating. I think Bud probably worked with, by the time he passed, maybe 800 different individuals who seemed to have been overwhelmingly authentic abductees.
Mm-hmm.
And in our time together, I got to be the bug on the wall, or, you know, the person sitting in as the witness to a hypnotic regression, or conduct the initial entry-level interviews. I read the letters. I was there to consult if Bud wasn't, and so on. Because the subject itself is so complex, challenging, to put it mildly, anxiety-provoking, and completely insane-sounding to anybody that's never seriously looked into it or seen any of the wide variety of court-level evidence.
Right.
Some of it very physical. It's certainly hardly all anecdotal and take-my-word-for-it kind of thing. For us, the most delicate aspect of this already challenging undertaking was when somebody would write to or contact Bud, who either had a history of these kinds of experiences or presented as such and seemed to be sane and not trying to fool anybody or any of that stuff,
mm-hmm.
and say, I am concerned for my child. I believe they are having these experiences, or I'm concerned that they may, because I now know enough from my research, my experience with working with you or what have you, that these other intelligences, whichever of these visitors are involved in abduction, follow bloodlines. They are interested in following generational. I know how that sounds, but the evidence supports that.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm reminded that in the old days, say, back in the 1970s, old days, when this was not a comfortable topic to be undertaken,
no.
It was avoided for good reason. UFO researchers, the so-called establishment, whether it was NICAP or MUFON or serious adults involved in the work, felt that it was rough enough being taken seriously, talking about radar returns, lights in the night sky, landing traces, burn marks, you know, the whole litany of sub-areas of study,
the nuts
without
and bolts.
Saying, I believe that, you know, human beings are being taken.
Right.
And so it was avoided. And although the Betty and Barney Hill case was taken seriously, and a handful of other type true abduction cases that kind of pioneered the field, it really wasn't until the publication of Missing Time, Bud Hopkins' first book, which came out in 1981, that folks started to pay more attention to the subject in the field. And I was speaking with a friend this afternoon who said, you know, I recently reread that book, and I was just completely taken aback again by Hopkins' tremendous research and the case that he makes for this, no matter how it sounds to an outsider. With that understood, David, I remembered that over the years, as somebody who would read the letters as they would come in, if Bud didn't have time, and he had worked out a code of symbols that I would put on the outside of an envelope, from fan letter, you know, I'll send them a note, or you should, to very serious probable case, you should contact this person personally, and everything in between, that every once in a while there'd be a letter that was so memorable that I would go to him and say, while maintaining the confidence of this individual, is it all right with you if I make a copy of this letter for my personal files, making sure that I can't even trace it back to who it is because I have blacked out the address, the proper names, et cetera, so that it is what it is. It's a letter written by somebody to you with no provenance that we can find back for potential future research, et cetera. And Bud said, sure. And I did it. And here I am, you know, 25 years or so later, going into that file and saying, my gosh, I have some letters here that are germane to this idea, either written with concern about a child or from an adolescent directly to Bud, that kind of thing. Then I recalled that although Hopkins gave, I'm sure it's safe to say, hundreds of lectures over the time that he was involved in the work, to the best of my knowledge and memory, he only once gave a talk on children and UFO abductions. And as it turned out, 20 years ago, I was working for a multimedia company, and my boss surprised me by basically optioning the rights to reproduce videos, it's that long ago, of lectures from this particular conference. The conference was called the Omega Conference, and some of your listeners may remember it. It was a very good conference. It took place every year for 10 years in North Haven, Connecticut. And by the time it ended, I think they had 111 video lectures. And everybody who was anybody spoke there over the years, and some up-and-comers and unknowns. I spoke there several times. I'm remembering that it's where Colin Andrews gave his very first talk in America, where we met and became friends, where he actually met the woman and he would end up marrying. Bud spoke there several times, and on one of the occasions, he gave a talk, again, on UFO abductions and children. And what I realized was it was a very good lecture, although I hadn't seen it in years. I had a copy of the video. I sent it to a friend who turned it into a DVD for me. I checked it out and thought, I could work with this, introducing other material, but, you know, show some segments from it and produce what I think would be a valuable and compelling talk on children and abductions, as well as Hopkins' work with them, including a very good psychological test that he developed with several mental health professionals, and the nomenclature, the different kinds of ways you could work with children with these images to dig deeper. And I know that some mental health professionals still use it. It's called the Hopkins Image Recognition Test, or HIRT. I have a copy of it and all of the instructions. Anyway, last month I went to New York City, as I do. It's my home, even though I don't live there anymore. And I met with my old bosses, who I remain friends with, and said, I'd like your permission, as the holders of this copyright, to, number one, be able to use a few brief segments from this video, you know, up and up legally, in the talk that I'm going to give in Laughlin in March. More, I'd like to know what I would need to do, or what you would be okay about for me to acquire the copyright for this one lecture from you. And they discussed it briefly, and then very kindly and generously gave me the copyright to
wow.
that talk. So I now, for the first time in my life, I have a copyright on a talk, and in this case, a very valuable one, from my mentor and dear friend and seminally important contributor to the field of ufology and scientific abduction research. So I am working away on background material, research development, the structure and strategy for this talk, which I will be giving for the first time at the end of March in Laughlin. And again, I cannot encourage strongly enough folks who, well, would really be interested in a major UFO experience, not with UFOs themselves,
right,
but
right.
with the personalities who follow the subject.
Mm-hmm.
You will hear, I am sure, I've gone over the list of lecturers, many of them who I am familiar with. They're not, you know, completely unknown.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's great that they're getting a shot to do this. I'm honored to be included. I'm really looking forward to going back to Laughlin, reconnecting with old friends, making some new ones, and including that in my professional year of presentations.
Yeah, I had a wonderful time, and I went there 2 years straight, and then they knocked it down from a week to what, 4 days, and moved the venue, and I had a great time in Laughlin. I mean,
yeah, if you do enjoy, you know, the whole casino thing,
mm-hmm.
There you go. It can be UFOs and slot machines or poker, which may be absolutely a dream for some folks.
Yeah.
Also, it is quite a remote and an interesting corner of Nevada. And as I recall, God, I hope nobody quotes me on this, I think it borders on Arizona, and yet
it does.
Third state.
It does.
Yeah.
California.
Colorado? I forget where they come together, but I know it's on the Arizona border, too. And as I recall, you could see Arizona from your hotel room in Nevada there if you had the room with the right angle.
Right. Not that that's any big deal, but, you know, while I was there, I saw goldfish, believe it or not. I did not know goldfish could be this huge.
Oh, yes, the carp that the Chinese had originally pioneered the breeding of. Yeah, they're pretty surreal. And if you've been drinking, you might think you've been drinking a great deal too much if you're not familiar with them. Also, just to be clear here, the International UFO Congress, which is kind of a clone of this new venture in the old venue and with the old format, is still up and running. And although it used to be every February, it is now going to be in September. So do not forget about the International UFO Congress coming at us in September. It is a completely separate event.
Are you going to be there as well?
I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah.
I am not positive, but I am optimistic that I will. Yeah. And, time will tell.
Yeah.
Right now, as of today, I just learned that I will be speaking at a conference that I have a special place for in my heart, because we don't have a lot of UFO congresses, events, conferences here in New York State.
Mm.
One would think with a city like New York, you know, they'd have a bunch of them, but it's not true, in part because venues are particularly expensive.
Yeah.
However, some of your folks listening may be aware of a little dot on the map on New York State, maybe 2 hours north of Manhattan, called Pinebush.
Oh,
yeah. A hamlet. It's not even a town. It's so small. But for some decades now, Pinebush keeps establishing itself as the center of the largest group of corroborated UFO sightings, events, reports, paranormal activity here in the Northeast, bar no location. And it's fairly close to a very good-sized air base, but that doesn't account for the round craft that are regularly
right.
in the area.
Right.
And for the past 5 or 6 years, a UFO conference and festival has been building there. It's actually one town over, because Pinebush isn't really large enough to handle it. But it will be, once again, this coming May. On May 18th, it will be billed as the Pinebush UFO Festival and Conference. It's a one-day event, and this year will feature, among others, my friend, friends and colleagues, Travis Walton, astronomer Mark D'Antonio, UFO researcher and statistician and writer Cheryl Costa, and several other great speakers. And it looks like next year it will graduate to be a full weekend event. But it's an awful lot of fun, kind of like a small Roswell UFO festival and conference, or the great event that's held every year in mid-May in McMinnville, Oregon, that has grown to great proportion now, too.
Yeah.
The fact is there is a handful of communities around this country, another one is Exeter, New Hampshire, that have every right to have events of this kind, because they are indeed the home of truly important UFO-related events.
So, yeah.
And this past September, the one in Exeter, New Hampshire, which is a great event, did graduate to be a full weekend after about half a dozen years of being a one-day event.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud to be a co-founder of that. And once again, can't speak too highly of what a terrific event it is. Of course, there are more UFO conventions and events and speaking venues around the country every year than we could probably cover in a single show. But I guess we're just, you know, this is the tip of the iceberg, and the part of the iceberg that I'll be clinging on to this year.
So right now I have to take another moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with the author and UFO researcher, Mr. Peter Robbins. And I was going to ask you about, first of all, you were talking about the Bud Hopkins and his research, and so many letters that came in, so many cases that he had. Are they still being pursued, these cases?
Not as such. Bud was an independent investigator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he's a MUFON member, that kind of thing. but he pursued his investigations on his own with a small team of assistants. And when he died, which was, gosh, now it's been 7 years.
I think so, yeah.
August of 2011. The work stopped, per se. I mean, it wasn't like there was a Bud Hopkins Jr. or anything like that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the Intruders Foundation, which was the nonprofit educational foundation that he created, I think 1990 or 1989, which I served on the board of with great pride. It was a valuable organization. We had a mandate to do what we could to be there to assist people in any way that we could who have been through these experiences and were having trouble with them or disturbed by what had happened to them, not uncommon. We also had as much outreach as we could to the media and the world at large to help educate them to how real this subject was. We put on ever so many programs in Greater New York, one major conference, two conferences, as well as an art show and I'm sure several dozen speakers brought in who, who lectured on the subject. But when all was said and done, it was a one-person-driven organization. And when Bud passed, it was very difficult for the core of us that wanted it to go on to find the support that we needed and the wherewithal. So I am not sure where ultimately Bud's extraordinary archive will end up, but those many thousands of letters, and that is no exaggeration, thousands of letters, many of which I read and ultimately boxed up and labeled, as well as his massive files, the tremendous number of recordings of interviews and regressive hypnoses are and should not, on a very real level, be available to just anybody. It's really rather a complex situation. They are being held by perhaps his closest friend in the field and good friend in general, that being Dr. David Jacobs, another well-known abduction researcher.
Oh, yeah.
But where we go with this in the future, I don't know. Yeah. I hope very much that, very, very much, that they, and obviously Dr. Jacobs' ultimate files and records, et cetera, find a permanent home where scholars and future responsible investigators and researchers can come to review material and that it is properly curated and that the privacy of individuals who write or wrote to people, in this case like Bud, is respected. But it does bring up some, you know, complex issues of how do we secure the privacy of people sharing in good faith some of their most intimate memories, in many cases the most shocking and life-changing ones and often the most frightening ones, without, you know, making it into a sideshow or a circus or...
Well, that,
they wrote
that brings
to somebody
up,
in good faith, and how do you protect that and at the same time make it accessible? Good question.
That brings up the question of John Mack's research.
Yes.
He had tons of letters and cases that he was working on. Whatever happened to that?
Well, that, that kind of evolved a bit differently. John, of course, who... for many of us, was one of our very favorite people in the field, with credentials that were just mind-boggling, a distinguished psychiatrist in clinical practice who was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and one of the most courageous UFO abduction researchers and experiencer researchers. John's career almost went down in flames when Harvard starting to feel the heat of people saying, what is this? You've got a professor of yours and a Pulitzer Prize winner looking into so-called alien abductions? Come
all right,
on.
All right.
John became the first faculty member since Timothy Leary in the 60s, who was called upon to prove the viability of his work. And as he told me after the fact, he had to have a very costly lawyer there with him. But he won his case overwhelmingly. In John's case, though, what happened to his research was different. John, tragically, was killed by a drunken driver in England in 2014, something which some people, understandably, still feel may have not been an accident.
Mm.
By chance, I was very close by at the time, and John was a dear friend, and I ended up doing my own investigation, getting hold of the court records and the like, and had to conclude that it really was a terrible accident.
Yeah.
And most frustratingly, probably caused by him not looking the proper way when he crossed the street, as many of us Americans do.
They drive on the other side of the street.
Yeah.
You look one way and, look the other way, silly.
Yeah. You know, it's gotten to the point, David, where now on most street corners, certainly in the big cities and in smaller towns as well sometimes, when you look down at a corner, it says look left for people like me. And I think, sadly, John.
Yeah.
Anyway, when John was alive, the organization that he had created was called PEER, which, as I recall, is Program for Extraordinary Experience Research. When he died, he had an actual staff and funding, and PEER became the John Mack Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that still exists and is viable and is based in Boston. I have not been in contact with them for some years, but all of his research is there.
Hmm.
And held under their auspices. So that's another story that may be accessible to scholars and educators and, you know, investigators who can make their case
but nobody's,
and gain access.
Nobody's working with these individuals that have filed a complaint, shall we say.
There are people around the country who are. They're just not as high visibility or as well known as John or David or Bud.
Right.
And I don't know if or who is in that position and affiliated with the John Mack Foundation might be doing that work right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's what I was getting at as far as Bud Hopkins was concerned, is someone working with these people?
Well, I can tell you right now that one of Bud as well, who remains a very dear friend, is a psychologist who I know I have, I can mention his name here. His name is Jed Trumbull, and he lives and works in Lower Manhattan, and he has a regular practice. But Bud consulted with him a great deal and referred quite a number of abductees to him.
Mm-hmm.
Jed takes the subject tremendously seriously. I know him to be a great guy, a very competent and respected mental health professional who has the courage to continue doing this. And he is, you know, in the listings in New York. And if somebody is interested in working with him, they've only to contact him. And if they can't find him, contact me, and I'll put you in touch with him.
Hmm. Maybe you could put me in touch with him as to a guest on this show. What do you think?
You know what? Hmm. I could and will do that.
I'd appreciate it.
He'd be a great guest for you. Terrific.
I bet. Not bad. I had one psychiatrist who dealt with alleged abductees quite a long time ago. I won't even mention his name, but this was quite a long time ago. And, oh, he was ready to talk. He was ready to spill the beans on these actual cases, right? I get him on the air, and I ask him a question. Yes. Okay. Can you elaborate? No. He would just, you know, give one-word answers. But anyway, I should not knock my guess.
Probably not a great idea.
No.
At the same time, in his defense,
we're losing you.
He may have been overly protective of individuals that he was working with.
Could be. But, yeah. What's happening to your phone?
It's still here.
Oh, okay. It was rattling there for a minute.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, okay. So anyway, very quickly, because we're running out of time, I'm afraid, but I wanted to ask you about History Channel's Project Blue Book.
Yes.
What do you think about that? Have you watched it?
Yes, I have. I can say without hesitation that I have very mixed feelings.
Really?
I think it was entertaining, and there is factual material included in it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't terrible. I think it's going to be successful as what I would categorize as infotainment. that line that is walked between hard, real information and entertainment, mm-hmm. in this case with the UFO-based theme.
Mm-hmm.
I guess nothing's perfect. I wish them well. I would rather see something that was fully documentary, but made in a way that fully engaged its audience. I think that's more of a challenge. And when you take liberties with fact, or, you know, that caveat of based on a true story, it can be misleading, confusing, and occasionally not in the service of the greater truth for people in the audience who don't know what's true and what's not true.
Yeah.
Colleagues have had the experience that I had to a degree of, you know, almost enjoying, oh, yes, that's true, that's not true, that's true, that's not true. I can say in its favor, it wasn't bad. But I personally find it frustrating, but I'm a bit of a snob in that respect. And we've had a lot of stuff on TV that's just been really not good at all relative to the subject.
Yeah.
So it's positive in that sense. I will watch with interest and curiosity as it continues, and I have a feeling commercially it will be successful for sure.
They did give the actual, for example, the first installment of the show, the captain that chased the UFO. He didn't fire upon it like they showed, but there was a captain who chased a UFO.
Yeah.
And that fact was put up there on the screen, and then it went on for another 50 minutes, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But Jalen Hynek never went up in the airplane to reenact it and crashed.
I know.
Yeah, but okay, it was fun watching it happen. So,
yeah.
Again,
when you have a real person and a famous person,
mm-hmm.
Who is iconic in any field of research, and you just, you know, you include them, but you sort of make them into a semi-fictional character.
Right.
And I have to question, you know, who gains by this. Except for the folks that make money on the project.
That was not to be too blunt.
It's complex. And
I'm still waiting for Hangar One to come back to TV, you know? A real documentary. I mean, like you say, I'm afraid people are going to look at Project Blue Book, the TV series, and consider a documentary, and that's not good. Mr. Peter Robbins, where can we go to get more information about your work?
Well, you can visit my very much in need of updating website, which will be updated in the next month, and that is Peter Robbins, N-Y, as in New York, peterrobbinsny.com, or visit me on my Facebook page where I post any upcoming events that I'm speaking at, broadcasts like this that I appear on, or hopefully right after the fact, like this show that we're completing right now, I will be posting a link on my page once I get it from you so that people can hear the show and share it with their friends at their leisure.
Well, I would appreciate that. Thank you so much.
You've got it, my friend.
And,
a pleasure hearing your voice again.
It was great hearing yours, and thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to.
Okay. Hope we can do this again.
We can.
Okay. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is UFOImplications.com. That's UFOImplications.com. And please stay tuned to WHFR.fm, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. Now, I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 12 noon, when we will again be exploring the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Featuring local and independent artists.
And dolls, you are at the Malt Shop with Daddy G and WHFR.FM. And we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice in the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the Malt Shop where the jukebox is playing. The kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.
To spend